Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I think that was the weirdest moment for me is when all of a sudden my dreams stopped being in Setswana and they started being in English. I was like, wow, what is going on with my life? Like, is this... I'm a Kiwi now.
Yeah.
Even now, I still wonder why I can't dream in Setswana, even though I can still speak Setswana, you know?
Yeah.
I try to force my dreams to be Setswana, but they just don't... They come out.
You just dream in English, yeah.
Kia ora, we're your hosts, Julie
and Sarade. We travelled around Aotearoa with our soundie Joey, meeting immigrant whānau, listening to stories and discovering what is said or not said between different generations.
These stories warmed our hearts and broke our hearts. And over this series, we invite you two to listen in on Conversations with My Immigrant Parents. For this episode of Conversations with My Immigrant Parents, we meet Judah and his two sons, Tafara and Pako. All three were born in Botswana, where the main languages are English and Setswana. Tafara is 25 and is Judah's oldest son.
Pako is 21 and came to Aotearoa with Judah when he was 5 years old. The two boys have different mums, and Judah and Pako initially stayed in Mahana, Nelson, where Pako's mum Annabelle was from. Because of some runarounds with immigration, it then took 5 years for Judah to bring Tafara over, so he came when he was 14. All three now live in Wellington.
Just a heads up, this episode contains strong language.
I've got five kids. Oh no, not five. Six, including my stepdaughter. Two girls in Africa. Two boys in New Zealand, Tafara and Pako. And I've got my stepdaughter, Shiloh, and my little baby, Stunya. They're nice kids, you know. I love my kids. We kind of like friends, you know, I treat them like my friends. Probably because Tafara is a bit older, he's a little bit more chilled and grounded. And Pako, he's a little bit wild, like the wild one. I'm taking that to age, but they're different characters.
Our dad's name is Samuel Judah Sumeng.
He's from Botswana, Africa.
He's 50 years old.
He's 50 years old, yeah. He's a bit of an academic.
Comedian, part-time.
Yeah, part-time comedian. Full-time grafter, bit all-around legend.
He's more of a best friend than a dad. He's just so open to the point where we don't really feel like there's the barrier of father and son.
You never like issue orders, it's always just he'll offer you wisdom, but it's still up to you.
Suggestions and wisdom.
The first time coming to New Zealand was a bit of a culture shock for me, to be honest. Like, I could hardly hear what people were saying. Everyone was talking so fast. I remember Barbara talking about wearable art. That's what it is. It was wearable art. I was like, what's wearable art? She had to slow down. Said, wearable art. Okay, wearable art. But she was like, wearable art. Wearable art.
You strung into one sentence. Eh?
Yeah. Mm. And you spoke as well, like fluently.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah. I think it was weird for me being so novel.
Yeah.
All the kids were like, oh, who's this? Who's this? I was like, a bit shy.
Yeah.
Strange.
Okay, I totally understand that. Especially being in Mahana, a small school like that was, you don't want to be too different.
Yeah.
You want to be like everybody, like all your mates, so you can blend in.
I mean, when you first came.
When I first came?
Yeah.
That was like an African boy has arrived. And you downed it. Damn.
I hadn't started school. I think there was like maybe 2 weeks in between before I started school.
Yeah, you just arrived. Yeah,
it might have been my first week actually. And, you know, back home we hunt like birds, pigeons, doves. And to me, I was just like, that's another dove. Like, you know, yeah. Let me just go kill that dove for myself and eat it. And Parks had a little air gun. You can still hunt like rabbits. Yeah, a little air rifle. And I was like, oh, this would be fun. Take a gun for a test drive and a killer bird at the same time. Like, how easy can it get? And kill the bird. Brought out to dad, I'm like, yo, check out this hunt I just got. And then he panicked. He's like, no.
This is protected.
That's illegal. You can't be going around killing birds like that. Just like, go bury it. Don't tell anybody about it. I was pretty confused and kind of mad. I was like, man, that was a good hunt too. Like, yes, I got very hit.
Waiting for the praise. Yeah.
What did you know? We buried by the estuary.
Yeah. We did. Never to talk about it. Oh, I learned that not to kill anything without asking after that.
I love the story so much, even though I hate the idea of killing a bird, but the story.
This is a good story. It took quite a bit of time for Judah to be able to bring Tafada over to New Zealand because Judah and Tafada's mum were never married. So Tafada doesn't share the same last name as Judah, and this meant immigration required proof that Tafada was Judah's son. They even went as far as to ask them to take a DNA test.
Oh, man, it took 2-3 years trying to get you to New Zealand and just the immigration. They just processing the immigration papers was difficult. New Zealand doesn't have an office in Botswana, like a high commission. We have to go to South Africa to do all that. So I talked to them about getting papers for my son to go to New Zealand. Their attitude is like they're talking to a foreigner, and then in the end they said, okay, if you want to really take this boy to New Zealand, we want to prove that he's really your son. Yeah, which is fair enough because there's been issues of child trafficking and all that stuff.
Yeah.
In the second or third year of trying that, the New Zealand immigration decided to do DNA test. We did the swabs and did the DNA, waited. I don't know how long we waited for that. It was a few months before the results came in.
Yeah, I think now you came. We did the test and then you left for a bit, maybe. You came back 3 times. First time you came, I think it wasn't a serious trip, like looking at me coming over. I was maybe talking to my mom and talking to my uncles and things like that about me leaving.
Yeah.
I got pretty excited about it, told literally the whole school, everybody.
Yeah.
It didn't happen straight away. And then the second time you came, I was like, okay, nah, it's definitely going to happen. And then
it didn't happen.
I was like, okay, obviously it's not going to happen at all. Like, maybe I should just stop telling people that I'm going to go overseas and I'm going to go live overseas. And then, I think it was like the next day you came to my school, I think. And I was in class and you're like, we're actually doing this. Get out of class. Even then, I didn't say goodbye to my friends because I didn't think it was real. I was like, it's not happening. It's just going to be another run around. We're going to go to somewhere. Then I have to come back again and... That time happened, and I picked my books in school when I left.
Nelson was a funny little town. It was interesting growing up there, though. Being a farm boy, living out those ways.
I'm gonna say like a good things about living in Nelson.
Yeah, the good things. I'm glad we left when we did. It's good to spend some time there, get a bit of perspective. Had we come straight from Africa to say living here, central Wellington, that would have been a way bigger culture shock, big towers and everything, compared to still the same running around outside, still the same lifestyle.
I never thought about it that way. Actually, it's a pretty good point.
Yeah.
Nelson got us grounded a little bit more. Right?
Yeah. We got the bare bones.
Yeah.
This is as bad as it gets.
It's not all rosy and happy time.
Because cities can be a little bit pretentious. Countryside, you get the real deal.
Like, I remember because you're doing some workshop at a holiday program and you arrive, and the guy's like, "Who are you?"
I'm
here to run the drumming. Yeah, I thought you were some Yahoo with your dreadlocks. I'm here to do the program.
I had forgotten that. Yeah, man. Yeah, I did a lot of those cultural workshops, drumming and storytelling workshops.
Oh, you did a couple, even at my school, you did a couple.
Yeah, the holiday programs, the arts festival. But this particular guy was in a church in Atafai.
Mm.
There was a program, a school, holiday school program happening there, and I had been booked. Man, and this guy is a church priest. And then I turned up, he looked me and he said, "Oh, who are you?" And then I said, "Oh, I'm here to do a school holiday program." And he's like, "Oh, I thought you were some Yahoo."
That was an inside joke for a while, the old Yahoo.
Like, what's a Yahoo?
Yeah, Nelson, I think, is just very small-minded. And
yeah,
there was a community, but you have to be... Yeah, you had to be there from the start, you know. You can't just join halfway and be part of the community.
Some of my experiences of Nelson, the ones that are vivid, is the bad ones.
Yeah.
When I was still at NMIT, when I was doing those courses I did there, one time I was just walking from the School of Music, just walking down the street to go and go in my car to go back home. And then these young people, Nelson people, driving past and they shouted at me, "Nigga!"
Yeah.
And they're youths. Mm. So it's those kind of things that when I think of Nelson, those memories always come back.
Depressing and vivid, as Judah says.
I think it's a really poignant point that Tafada makes about how Nelson's a really small-minded community and that you can't just join halfway. Probably especially also for him coming at a slightly later age than Paco. Mm. Paco coming when he was 5 to Nelson is very different to Tafada coming at 14, having lived most of his life and developed all his kind of identity in Botswana, and then feeling like, how does he fit into this predominantly Pākehā town?
I really feel like there are a lot of communities in the South Island, because the South Island is so much wider than the North Island, where it is hard to join halfway through. And I feel like, I just noticed that when I moved to Christchurch when I was 14, like I really felt you just had to be born in Christchurch to be able to sort of feel at home in Christchurch, and you probably have to be white. It was the first place in New Zealand that I'd ever lived, and I'd lived like 4 or 5 different cities, that I was like, oh, I feel like I will never be part of this place.
Are most people there, like, from there?
I think so. I think most of the people I went to school with were from there, yeah. And their parents were from there.
Yeah.
And maybe their grandparents, you know, it's just quite, it was quite different for me.
Entrenched.
Yeah. And if you come in late, you're always going to be on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you come in late and you're a person of colour. Especially if you come in late and you're black.
So only a couple of years after Judah, Paco and Paco's mum Annabelle moved to Nelson, Annabelle got sick and sadly passed away. In this next section, Judah and Paco remember what a devastating experience losing Annabelle was.
When Annabelle died, when your mum passed away, man, it was so hard. Because I never thought someone so close to me is going to die.
Yeah, and especially at a time we would just come from Africa,
You know,
we were thrown in the deep end, sort of our only connection to the country.
I was going to say, I bet you would have felt even more lonely after that.
Yeah, man, I felt like I was thrown in the middle of a desert, you know.
Mm.
No family, apart from the dance, and everybody was feeling sad, and, you know, it was really tough. You remember the time in Christchurch?
Yeah, I remember.
When your mom got sick and we went and stayed in Christchurch, we were there for about a month.
Yeah, I remember that.
Walking around, and then all of a sudden we get a phone call saying, yeah, she's in a coma.
Yeah.
I don't think I've actually ever heard the full story.
Yeah.
Or actually what happened.
Then what happened was, 2007, she just started having headaches. We were like, what's going on? Like, non-stop headaches. And then we went to the doctors, and then in the end, maybe after a week or two weeks of headaches, we went to the hospital to get a check, and then the doctors did an MRI scan, and they found that she had a dark patch on in her brain.
Yeah, it was a brain cancer,
brain tumor.
Yes, brain tumor.
Yeah.
And then they realized that it was serious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we flew to Christchurch same day and went to Christchurch Hospital, and we were there. It took a long time also to get the diagnosis. Like, they had to do a what they call biopsy, get a sample from the brain.
Yeah.
You know, sent to Melbourne.
Tested off.
Yeah, it took weeks, man. We were hanging around Christchurch, and she was on all sorts of medications to keep her out of the pain, because she was in pain.
Yeah.
And by the time the results came back from Melbourne, they had to confirm. It was just to confirm what kind of cancer it is.
I remember, it was too dangerous to operate.
Yeah, it was too dangerous to operate, so... And then the doctors had to decide what kind of treatment the options it could be. And the week that they decided to set her date to start the treatment, that's the week that she went into a coma.
Yeah. Well, after she passed away, were you thinking about going back home more? Or?
Yeah, man. If it wasn't for thinking about you guys, because I thought it would have been better for you guys to do school here.
Is that why you pushed me to come here more? Is it because you knew that she was not feeling well, or?
We started the process.
She passed that we really tried to.
I mean, before she got sick, we already had plans to bring you here, and then after she passed, I had to do it because I knew Paco was already in school here, and I knew we were not gonna be going back sooner.
Mm.
And I thought it would be better for you both to come here.
Yeah.
Once she got in a coma, the doctors said they don't think she's going to wake up. Yeah.
So you didn't end her life support. She just passed away while she was in coma.
Well, they took her off the pump.
Oh, they took her off the support. They made decision that, no, she's never going to get out of a coma. So they had to send us home.
While she was in a coma, I remember a nurse came in asking what we're doing, and Barb's just like, "Oh, we're just fishing." And that's when I realized what the situation was. I was like, "Oh, we're just fishing, are we? Like, she's not going to wake up."
Yeah.
What was that like for you when you realized that moment?
Because the whole time I was like, "No, she's going to be fine, she's going to be fine." And that's true. Barb's given up. Maybe it's real.
Yeah, I mean.
Did you ever cry?
Yeah, I was crying for days.
Yeah, I mean, I was the same. Like, the whole time we were in Christchurch waiting for the results from Melbourne, I was sure that she was going to be fine until she went into a coma. Then it hit me that
your hope was getting a bit lower.
Yeah, that things are really serious.
Yeah.
It was hard, man. It was the hardest thing.
Mm.
The hardest, I can't think of anything that's a difficult experience emotionally and also just thinking of, you know, someone you've lived with for so long and you've journeyed together.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden they just die, you know. You know, we didn't think any of us is going to die anytime soon. We
had plans, live for a long time.
Had plans of getting old, you know.
Did you ever think like, oh, I'm not going to find another love again? Which point were you like, well, maybe it's time I should try find somebody, or did it just kind of happen?
I think it just happened because I had friends, I had people coming in and out.
Yeah, that was a funny time when you and Millie started getting together.
How did you feel about it?
They didn't even tell me. They kept it a secret. I remember one time I was just in the lounge, just Shiloh and Cielo, and they're like, oh, so what's it like now that Shiloh's your stepsister? I was like, they don't go out. What are you talking about? Like, that ain't that there. It's just the boys at the moment.
My dad's just hanging out with his friend.
Yeah. And Shiloh's like, no, they go out. Mum said they go out. I was like, oh, you're talking shit. Like, get out of here.
Oh, did Shiloh tell you first?
Yeah. I didn't believe her. I was like, no, that's not happening.
It's nonsense.
Yeah, no, we tried to kind of like at the start just to be kind of like quiet about it. We didn't want to, you know, jump in and try to scare you.
Because you both have kids, eh?
Yeah. So delicate kind of like introduction
step
process.
Step by step.
Step by step, yeah.
Well, I can't even remember the day I met Millie. I think the day I met Millie was the day you forgot to pick me up.
From school?
Yeah. That was the day I met Millie. Yeah, somebody forgot to pick me up on the way there.
That's notorious. Yeah. I remember one time outside my school.
Something must have happened.
Nah, yeah, yeah. This was a frequent. Every time you give me a lift home, nothing the teachers happened. Would be gone before me. I'd still be waiting outside. They're like, are you sure he's coming? I said, just wait. Just wait. Like, I'm the only one at the school still. Then you pull up.
He'll be here eventually.
Oh, man, what? You know, those times was tough also working in the orchards because it was like, it was always rushing around.
Yeah.
Always late for something.
No, I didn't know any better though. I was just like, this guy's just being lazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just like, my dad just doesn't care about me today, bro. Like, nah.
Oh, man. It was tough. I mean, there was times when I was starting work before sunrise and finishing at last light, picking fruit.
Yeah, no, it's tough.
Yeah, well, it was really tough.
I remember when you got sunburned from picking fruit.
When I first cut my dreads, because I used to have...
Yeah, your neck exposed.
Yeah, I used to have those big dreads and then I cut them and then my neck got exposed to the sun forever. I had them for maybe 18 years.
Yeah.
That was this time I was doing odd jobs. That was the time when I used to be late picking you guys up.
Yeah. You forget things.
Yeah. It was too many things to do. It was too many things to do, man. Yeah.
Single dad life, eh?
Yeah, it was tough. And then I did pruning trees as well. You get paid per tree. How many trees you have pruned for the day? Sometimes it was like maybe $5 for a tree, depending on the size of the tree.
Yeah.
And you have to make money, you have to really go hard and prune as many trees per day as you can.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember when I had
couple tunnels.
Yeah, I had that.
I remember that.
From using secateurs for a few years. But yeah, we had good times.
Remember one time when you had a gig, something in Takakib, and we're camping there, but I was lying by the fireplace. And then some drunk woman comes over talking about having a cold child services or something. Like, where's your dad? What are you doing? Like?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember. There was always people threatening to take you off. When I moved from Mahana to Richmond, Paco's auntie, she thought maybe it's better if I give up the boys so they can be with her. I don't know if you ever knew about that.
Yeah. Get out of here.
Yeah. I refused.
Yeah.
I told her, no, you're not going to take my boys. It's not like they were suffering or anything. We had everything we needed. Yeah. Was just that
we just didn't have wireless internet. I think
we didn't have internet and all those stuff things. I mean, I don't know if you guys felt like we were suffering. No, I didn't. Really. We were not suffering. Yeah, we never went hungry. We always had food, lived in proper housing.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a point where I had a falling out with Paco's auntie. And also it was little things like painting a house. The house needed renovation. And we were going to paint the house because that's how it started.
Yeah.
She came and saw the kids doing, helping me. And she got angry that I was letting the kids do the painting. That, you know, I probably don't know what I'm doing. And then I decided that I don't want to be here anymore. I did get upset about it because she was not talking nicely, you know. I'm putting it nicely here. She wasn't saying it nicely. We had a falling out, and I decided to move out of the family trust house to move into Richmond from Nelson. And then that was the point where she suggested that perhaps she can have the boys instead of me living with the boys because my financial situation was not stable. But I did refuse. I said, no, I'm not gonna let anybody take my boys off me. And the other instance of
threatening to call what are they called, those people who take children away?
Yeah, someone threatening to call children away. I was at a gig. I took Paco with me to the gig. And then I was on stage playing and Paco was just lying there watching, looking at the stars.
Yeah.
And being happy. And this woman actually talked to Paco instead of talking to me, told Paco that she's going to call the...
It's like, what?
Family services.
Like, my dad is 5 meters away on the stage.
Yeah, and I could see him where he was, so...
I remember just lying there stargazing and then just this big face just completely obstructs my vision, starts screaming at me about...
Yeah.
How I shouldn't be lying there.
Yeah, apart from those two situations of people threatening to take you guys away, I don't remember anybody else unless someone will ever talk to you about it.
Well, like you say, we were poor, but we weren't impoverished.
We were not suffering. Yeah. You know, we didn't have the luxuries of what some other families had, like internet and all that.
I remember I'd get like a letter from school asking you to pay money, I just put it straight in the bin, like, oh, dad doesn't need to see it. Dad doesn't need to see this. Like,
too much stress.
No, he doesn't want to see this bill. I'll just hold on to this. The school can wear it.
I can't believe you did that.
I've done some stuff, like, even for like the school uniforms, I'd always try to get the secondhand one rather than the brand new one. I'm pretty sure the whole school uniform that I got was all secondhand except for the blazer. I think that was the only thing that I paid money for, and that was only because none of the blazers could fit me.
Yeah.
But everything else, like the pants and everything, was all like secondhand and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't cheap, that whole
school. Yeah, that school was too expensive, stuff, to be honest.
And there was always things to pay at school. You know, we paid a lot of stuff. Yeah, no, we survived some loopholes.
Yeah.
I remember having to have a secondhand uniform, and it's really hard to hide that your uniform is secondhand. You know, like, you can't really make it look like firsthand. And I think I always, like, felt that.
I actually remember when I was, like, first at primary school, maybe we couldn't afford a uniform at all. We had a school uniform at the school, but I would just wear this other outfit every single day. Like, the school uniform was green, and I had this, like, yellow outfit that I just wore as my own. I think it was just, like, my uniform until I could afford to buy the uniform. And we also have these photos of me little on holiday, and I'd just be wearing my school uniform because, like, I mean, they're clothes. Why not wear them?
But, yeah, I think it's just something that our society as a whole does not appreciate how much our lives are actually held up by the labour of migrant workers here.
Mm.
Whether it's fruit picking like what Judah did, like so many of our systems are held up by the labour of migrant workers.
So in this next section, Judah remembers when Puckle started to become ashamed of his identity and stopped speaking his mother tongue.
Yeah, you still remember moving to New Zealand, Paco?
Yeah.
The first time when you came here?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were 5 and, I mean, you got to a point with going to Mahana school, when I tried to speak to Sezwana to you, you started refusing to speak back because you were embarrassed.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to blend in with all your mates.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
All those times?
You know, I remember those times.
Yeah.
In New Zealand, people see you're black, like I'm looked at as black, and then back in Botswana, over there I'm white, over here I'm black. Like this, it was just always an effort to try blend in.
In Africa, you used to get it as well, like a lot of people used to call you Lokwanyana.
Yeah.
Which means like a little white boy. I remember one time you were, I don't know, maybe you were 3 or 4, but it was just before we left Africa, and we were walking in town, and this woman came. Yes, person, she was pointing at you and said, Lokwanyana. And you said, wow, umaka. Which means you are a liar. I always remember that because you were on point. She called you a white boy and you're not really a white boy.
Yeah, especially being in New Zealand, like you never let us forget that, you know, we're from Botswana.
Yeah, I always remember, make you boys remember that. Remember you are Africans.
Yeah.
Don't forget that. Yeah, no, I always wanted you guys not to lose your identity because it's not a nice thing to lose your identity and you can really physically feel lost.
Yeah,
no, I don't think you realize the importance of having your identity until you get older, though. Like, as a kid, you don't really see that it's important, you know. It's just, it's, you just see it as another task, like, oh, I have to be African today.
For you, Tafara was different because you were already older when you came here. The identity crisis was not the biggest problem for you.
Yeah, I think for me it was a little easier. And I've already, like, I'm back in Botswana. I was moving a lot around anyway. For me as well, if one personality didn't work in that last school, the next school, I'm going to try a different personality. Yeah. So by the time I got here, I was used to trying different personalities and trying different ways of blending in. So it was just a matter of like, okay, how am I going to blend in this time? What am I have to do to be a part of the circle, you know? And it took me a year. I don't know if you guys actually know the story, but everybody that I went to school with them will tell you that for a whole year when I first moved to Garen, I didn't talk to anyone. I stayed on the fields next to the rugby fields, just literally just looked at people, just observed them, looked at how they act, listened to how they talked. And that was just my way of learning things. It was just sitting from the sidelines. It was weird, but it helped out for me.
Yeah, the amount of
moving
around we did definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely
you never told
experience.
Me it's good.
Nah, I didn't tell anybody about it. I just, that's how I dealt with life, you know. I just moved in and... I just found it easier to watch from a distance and gauge from a distance.
Yeah, cultural adaptation is a process. And I think it's different people have got different strategies of adapting. You know, by the end of the day, you go to bed feeling really tired just from socializing, you know, talking and thinking, analyzing what people are saying. Sometimes someone says something to me, it'll take me an hour before I realize what they had said.
Yeah.
You know, it's like later. Oh, this is what that person said.
I don't know if you're going through this, but like, did you find yourself that your dreams, the more you started speaking English, your dreams started being in more in English than in Setswana, and then all of a sudden all your dreams are in English?
Yeah.
I think that was the weirdest moment for me is when all of a sudden my dreams stopped being in Setswana and they started being in English. I was like, wow. What is going on with my life? Have I really transisted? Like, is this... I'm a Kiwi now. Even now, I still wonder why I can't dream in Setswana, even though I can still speak Setswana, you know?
Yeah.
It just, I try to force my dreams to be Setswana, but they just don't... They come
you're
out
just
all in English.
You just dream in English, yeah.
You dream about what you're doing and you're not speaking Setswana.
Yeah, and the conversations of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the first few months I was streaming in Setswana and I don't even know how long it took.
You just switched there.
Switched and then all of a sudden I was streaming in English. It's an interesting thing with dreams.
When we were recording this, Julie was like grabbing my arm and looking at me like and maybe almost crying.
I was that emoji with the weepy eyes. Yeah, I don't know why I felt so much from that. And even now, just listening again, I feel like it's a really beautiful metaphor or analogy for just loss of identity. And it's something that happens so slowly over time that you can't really pinpoint how it happens. But this is like an example of a, like a tangible situation that changes that you can identify and you're like, how does that happen? And him trying to say, I'm trying to force my dreams to be this way, but I can't. And why can't I?
I mean, I just can't relate. So
I can't relate.
No, because I've only ever grown up speaking English. I've only ever lived here. I can't. Yeah, I don't know what that's like.
Okay, yeah. Your whole life has been here.
Yeah.
So it's not like you've actually had a move where your identity shifted because of a move.
No. I mean, I've moved a lot, but. There's never been a negotiation of
becoming a Christchurch identity.
Absolutely not.
Maybe it is just because I had a different first language that I now feel disconnected to that hit me harder. Yeah,
definitely.
With my job applications, it's always like I apply for jobs that I know I'm qualified for or been a little bit overqualified, but I get denied the opportunities and it's always... And sometimes I've asked for feedback to tell me why I didn't qualify for the job. The employer said I didn't know how to speak English.
Yeah.
Things like that. But I think it's in the name.
Yeah.
I don't have the right names. you know, my names don't sound Kiwi.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but I feel like if people haven't met you and spoke to you, they might just take from your name that you're not the right candidate.
Yeah.
Culturally.
Yeah, no, I agree with that a lot.
When I came here, I didn't have much of qualifications. I'm a musician, you know, I've always played music. But after I came to New Zealand, especially after Annabelle passed away, and I felt like I was so alone and I had to find ways of looking after myself and the boys. So I took some courses, and also to try and get away from the orchard work. Every time I get a little qualification, I look for work that is matching that qualification. I never succeeded. I never got a job, and then I went on, did my honors degree, finished my master's end of last year, and still no job. So, I mean, I'm currently working as a self-employed contractor, and I do jobs that are not related to what I have studied. I suspect that will be the rest of my days in New Zealand.
So that's always a shame to see that all the labor you put in not bear fruit.
Yeah.
If you think, back 7 years picking apples to now
a
master's degree, like, it's not a complete failure, babe.
Exactly. And I've got experience.
It's weird, though. Like, it's weird because maybe it's also an age thing. I don't always believe it's truly a name thing. But, like, again, I'm from a different age and different era. So I think there is jobs out there for people that are not Kiwi, but
you've got specific skills.
It requires a lot of specific skills, but also the age, I think, is one of the biggest factors in applying for jobs and things like that. You know, you're 50 now, and as far as they're concerned, you've run out of your energy. You know, you should be retired or not trying to start a new career. Yeah, you know,
yeah. No, I totally agree with you. Ageism,
big ageism. But I think back home is the opposite, isn't it? Like, if you're older, you kind of have more experience, you're more wiser, so you're more likely to be hired for those kind of positions.
Ageism, it does work, I agree with you, but even here, there's people my age who are working in the government now. Now I'm a qualified policy analyst.
Yeah.
I could get a job analyzing policy or advising on policy.
Yeah.
And those are the jobs I've been looking for now.
Yeah.
But I have, like I said, I've given up on the prospects of looking for work.
The Kiwi perception of Africans is obviously still, like, it's not amazing, but say compared to the general Kiwi perception of Māori people, I think we're probably looked at in a more positive light. I've almost seen it work in the reverse. Like, they're surprised to see, you know, an African person be well-spoken or something, and then you get sort of, you're almost perceived as better than you are just because you're better than you're expected to be.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely see that happening. Yeah, for sure. Like, the more well-spoken you are as a African.
Yeah, like someone just as smart, like, as me, wow, that's why.
This guy's so smarter just because I'm black. Mm. You know, he speaks really smart. He's obviously well-educated, even though he's not necessarily
same
educated.
As every other person. Yeah, like, you just weren't expecting me to be, like,
talk like the way you wanted me to talk.
Very depressing.
I think it's explained in such a good way as well. When someone thinks so lowly of you that somehow they think you're better.
I'm constantly surprised by my capacity to be
outraged. Like, even when they're trying to compliment you, but it's actually a form of white supremacy.
Yes. In this next section, Judah, Tafara and Pako discuss whether they feel a sense of belonging to the broader African community in Wellington.
There's quite a core group of young African people, especially in Wellington, that are making a big effort to make it a community and making sure everyone's connected. And that's really helped with identity as well.
I actually think for the younger group, like our age, me and Pako's age, we have a community without having a community. Like, everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows what everybody's up to. Like, but we don't necessarily go around seeking that information. We just know just because we're all in that same kind of circle. African. So
Yeah, and I think it's slightly different for you guys. For my generation, I think the African community, I feel like it's fragmented.
Mm.
Ethiopians are Ethiopians.
Mm-hmm.
Eritreans are Eritreans.
Yeah.
And then us from the south, even with Zimbabweans. I mean, I've got a few South African friends and Zimbabwean friends. We don't really hang out as a community, but we have conversations. You got a much better sense of community than us, the older people.
Yeah. Yeah. In New Zealand, that we don't see each other. It's like, oh, we're the Botswana boys. It's the African boys.
Yeah, African.
So everybody else that's from Africa doesn't see each other as Ethiopian boys. It's like, oh, we're just Africans. So we all listen to this certain music.
Yeah, yeah.
We all watch anime. So there's always that one little element thing that
brings
us together. Not necessarily being African itself, but there's always something else that brings us.
No, definitely generation. So you guys, your generation, you all speak English.
Yeah.
So it's easy. You can speak to each other easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for my generation, there's a lot of Africans who don't speak English. So even if you really want to express that identity socialization,
it's hard to do.
There's still people, like I always greet East Africans, especially older men and older ladies. I always say hello. Sometimes I say, where are you from?
I don't always speak
and
English.
Then they just nod their head, you know, you say, where are you from? They just nod their head. It's like, that's the end of the conversation. Yeah. They're gone.
Yeah.
Speaking with the identity thing, I find out speaking to an African person, like, oh, where are you from? And they want to say, like, oh, Lower Hot Bros. Like, bro, come on, where are you from?
I've heard a couple of times where I'm like, you know that's not what I meant. Bro, you know what I mean.
We both African. I'm not trying to rule you.
I know you live in Lower Hot.
I don't even ask young people anymore because that's what I've got. Yeah. Ask people of your age.
I've actually heard a couple of times.
They tell me the suburb in New Zealand. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard a few people where I have asked them like that and they kind of got offended that I asked them.
Yeah, and so, well, can you not say?
No, like obviously you live in Lower Hutt, like, but where's your ethnicity from? Yeah. And they get offended by that question. They're like, no, like, I'm a Kiwi. You shouldn't be asking me.
Mm.
Whereas I'm from, like, but you obviously not Asian Kiwi, like.
I feel a lot of like East Asian, like Indian.
Yeah.
Sort of, I always have to say afterwards, share that I've migrated as well, just to make them feel a bit more comfortable.
To reassure them that.
Yeah, so I'm not asking. Asking because I've had the same experience. Yeah. Like, ask them where they're from.
There's definitely a certain situation where you feel like you have to explain yourself why you're asking certain questions.
What I've also noticed with Africans, some people, especially your generation, they kind of like don't want to talk too much about Africa.
Yeah.
There's definitely certain people
I've talked to young people who kind of like, if you start raising the issue of Africa or ask them, oh, what part of Africa you come from? They look like they are blush or they're embarrassed. Yeah. They want to walk away.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a guy the other day that I had to get his details for his receipt for when he was buying shoes. And I was like, oh, what's your first name? He's like, oh, Thabo. I was like, oh, Thabo. Like, your name is Thabo, not Thabo.
You know,
like, but he felt like he had to pronounce it that way to me because he didn't know whether I spoke or that was from Africa or not. But I was like, oh, you mean Thabo? He's like, oh yeah, Thabo. You know what I mean? Like,
Thabo.
He just said it like in a way where it was like pronounced by a European person. Yeah. But then I was like, oh no, like, I know the name you're talking about is Thabo, not Thabo. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah. Now you from Botswana too? It's like, yeah, I'm from Botswana. He's like, yeah, I'm from South Africa. Is like, yeah, I realize the name. Like, you know. Yeah. But it's just funny that even for me, sometimes when I tell people my name, if it's not an African person, I'm gonna say it's Tafara.
Yeah.
You know, but if it's somebody that African is Tafara.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain pronunciation
I'll introduce myself differently to someone from the islands.
Or most people I just tell them, just call me Tef. Because that's what everybody else calls me. And then if it's an African person, I'd be like, give them a full name. Yeah. Call me Tafara.
Yeah, identity is an interesting phenomenon.
It definitely is interesting how we kind of change ourselves, even within our own communities, because of how we've assimilated. And something I really notice when I go into restaurants, like Chinese restaurants or takeaways, and I know I'm speaking to someone who's Chinese and English is their second language, and I know that it would be like easier if I just spoke Mandarin and then we're both speaking English, like it's both of our second languages. even though we kind of know the first language, and it's just strange, and I feel like I'm like lying or pretending, like I'm denying my identity in front of them.
Do you think it's always harder to be like, to be whatever your culture or identity is in front of other people who know more about it, because you're more likely to fail?
Yeah, you're more likely to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And you don't want to shame yourself, so you just pretend you're not part of that at all.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe it's because I'm part white, but I feel like I can be more comfortable being like, yeah, I'm Sri Lankan in front of white people than I get in front of other Sri Lankan people, because they're like, really? And I'm like,
so true.
But then I hear so many people saying this as well. Like, I don't, it's not just, yeah. I feel like everyone has this.
It's like imposter syndrome for your own identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in this next part, Judah talks about where he sees himself growing old.
Definitely, I would like to be an old man in Africa. There's many reasons for that. I love New Zealand. I call New Zealand home, but Africa is my home. And I don't want to end up in old people's home here, in a retirement home. We don't have retirement home system in Africa. You get old in your own house and looked after by your family until you are a dead old man.
When your father passed, I noticed it in you. You changed a lot. You're like, nah, I need to get back. I'm not dying here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that my father dying, it made me realize really I need to go back home. Yeah. You know, because I think about my own mortality.
Yeah.
You know, and I think about my age. I'm getting old, and I don't want to be an old man here. I see myself moving back to Africa in the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Mm.
Entitlement was a word I was looking for. You feel like the sense of entitlement you get from being at home, like you just feel more comfortable. More,
yeah, exactly.
Like you can go be an old man, walk around the streets,
not
feel like you're in someone else's.
I mean, you don't have to be lifted up in a plane if you die, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
You can just die and we carry you down 2 meters down the road to bury you.
Bury me. Yeah. If things were go my way, I would be moving next year. I'll be back in Africa next year, but I don't want to be in my 60s in Africa.
I think that's my goal too, you know. I want to be retired back home. Like, I want to have kids, maybe have them grow up in New Zealand or something, somewhere else. But definitely when it comes to laying back and starting the farming, going back home for that.
Yeah. There's no place like home.
Mm.
New Zealand is always going to be our second home, but Africa is our home.
Mm. I feel at home both places. Obviously, I've got identity here.
I think for you, it would take a little longer to make that decision, though.
Yeah. The idea of home has never been something super crystal clear for me. When I was little, I used to always wish I was just either black or either white, because then I could at least go somewhere without, you know, seeming like an outsider.
Mm.
Yeah, the home's just where you feel comfortable.
Doesn't, like, time nowadays make you feel more grateful that you're both, though?
Yeah, no, for sure now.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you have less perspective as a kid and whatnot, but obviously I'm happy with who I am now. But the idea of home has never been something super rock.
So, when
people ask me, oh, where do you prefer? I'm just like, oh, I've lived both places. I enjoyed both places. You know? It's never been like, this is my home or this is my home.
Mm. And you got two homes.
Yeah.
You got options.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a good thing.
Yeah, well, I think about the Christmas killing the goat in Africa, or Christmas, you know, at Thelma's house in Nelson, it's the same feeling. Still Christmas with the family.
Yeah.
I think I'd be just as comfortable in either setting.
I'm super proud of you guys. You know, you grew up into a fine young man and kind of like happy that you both turned out fine after all, you know, after all.
Just kind of happy. Not fully happy, just kind of
I'm happy, man.
I think it's crazy.
I'm pretty proud of you, boys. You make me proud every time, you know.
I don't know. I think you made fatherhood look pretty easy. It made me feel like I can be a dad anytime I want to.
Yeah.
You made it seem pretty effortless. So as long as I have boys, I know I'll be okay.
Yeah.
This is the first family we've had on the podcast where we've just had the men from the family talking. And I love this episode, and I really love that it ends with Te Whara saying that he thinks his dad has made fatherhood look easy.
Mm.
That must be such a cool thing to hear.
As a parent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we want to say a huge thank you to Judah, Te Whara and Pako for sharing these personal stories, for opening up about the grief and loss that has happened to the family, for opening up about their struggles with identity and finding work and their journeys here in Aotearoa. Nō mātou te maringanui. We are so fortunate to hear from you.
You can check out photos and videos of all our families on Facebook at Where Are You From Really, Instagram at Combos With My, and on RNZ's website. Conversations with My Immigrant Parents was created, produced and directed by Julie Zhu and Sarai De Silva. Location recording by Joey Siasoko. Studio recording by Jill Eva Craig at The Secret Beehive. And sound edited and mixed by Emmy Pagoni.
Our cover image is illustrated by Ngā Mutane Jones at Miss Memo and designed by Sonia Milford. A huge thanks also to Kay Elmers and Tim Burnell from RNZ Commissioning. Conversations with My Immigrant Parents was made possible by the RNZ NZ On Air Innovation Fund. He kō nei ipurangi tēnei mā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.